Oh, Super. What's the word? How you doing, sir?
Hey, I'm not doing too bad. We just we are we're on the quarter system in Northwestern, so I'm back in the classroom,
Oof.
and we're in week two, so we're kind of late, but things are kind of getting back in motion on campus.
What's the vibe on campus? Are the kids are kids like happy to be in school these
I
days?
think so. I mean, the sun is shining, the sun is out, it's nice. It's like we have a few more weeks of good weather.
Yeah.
Things are doing good. But today was a weird day because I was asking around my phone. I was texting you earlier today. My phone
Yeah.
has been, oh, is it back? It's just now finally back online. Well, what's it called? SSO or SOS mode when you're
I
out of
think it's
service?
called conspiracy, brother.
I
Anytime
thought
phones go out these days,
it was
I'm
my
over
phone.
nervous.
And I went on Twitter and I saw that Verizon had issued a statement like something was amiss with the network, but it took hours, and that's and so in these days my mind immediately went to
Yeah, you ain't gotta say it, don't get us banned.
every on CNN. How often it just says Iran? It's like Iran comes
Yeah.
up, so we don't fly under the radar. We don't fly under the radar, and I just immediately, without even looking at the news, I was like, so Iran is up to this. Somehow Iran is
Somehow,
responsible.
man. These are, I mean, it's always crazy times, but these days, it couldn't be. Yeah, anytime. If I drop a call, I think I dropped a call 3 days ago and I was ready to go invest in a bunker, rations for a year and a half. Man, I don't trust nothing when the
I'll
phones
tell
start
you.
acting funny. Having phones these days, it can be, you gotta
Yep.
watch out. You gotta watch
Yeah.
out. Walkie-talkies, pages, sidekicks,
See,
star text, whatever.
this is the world of a comic. This is comedian world.
Man,
What's
this is
going
the
on?
world
What's
of
going on with
Chicago.
you, Mike? How you doing? I know you've been on the road. What are some
Yeah,
flashpoints? What's
man.
happening in your world?
Man, honestly, this got the studio. So there's other people there. There seems to be a bubble and a swell for people don't want to get their messages out, whether that's comedic, whether that's a particular take on the world. So I have the studio at the house, man, and it's starting to bubble up. So there's a lot of people that really want to get their messages, their ideas, their point of views out there. And there's a couple of people that are doing comedy. There's a couple of people that are doing culture. There's a couple of people that are talking about news and current events, man. So it's good to see that. It feels almost like a gift and a curse that there are so many voices, so many different point of views, but also I appreciate that you can determine whatever your particular truth in, because we
Yep.
get to see from two worlds that are next door neighbors, but not
It's true.
necessarily under the same roof. But
That's
hey,
true.
good
And
conversations.
I think today's episode is one of those where, our last episode, we talked about criminal justice, and it's not
Yeah.
something that necessarily, at least for me as an observer, that you see come up in comedy a lot. So it was great. And I saw Kyrie, by the way, at the Lincoln Lodge.
Oh
He was
yeah.
shout out Kyrie. He was great. His set was
Big shout out to
incredible.
Kyrie.
Incredible.
Yeah.
But today's topic, we're gonna get into AI, right? And everyone's talking about AI, and that's the but one thing I've noticed is that a lot of comics talk about AI.
A
I feel
lot.
like it's become the a topic of discussion. It's kind of traveled across different domains. So I'm excited.
Yeah.
This topic happens to intersect with some of my own research and work.
Oh yeah.
So I'm
All
kind of,
right.
but I'm not. I'm coming in as a listener today.
I'm
And
definitely trying to learn.
I'm trying to learn and see where this conversation takes us. We have two incredible guests. I'm going to start off by introducing Alex Hanna, and then I'm gonna pass it to you, Mike, and we're gonna welcome in comic and CPS teacher, David
Oh
Donick,
yeah.
which is incredible because it embodies exactly what we're trying to do here on PCWB. So welcome back, listeners. That was a long intro. Welcome back, listeners, to the fourth episode of PCWB. Professor and a comedian walk into a bar. I'm Saper Vakil, your co-host.
And I'm your other co-host, Michael Knight.
All
Episode
right.
four, sir.
Episode four, we're getting going. Alex, welcome.
Yeah.
Dr. Alex Hanna, welcome. Let me. I'm gonna try to give you an intro that's unique to my lens on you, Alex. And I hope you appreciate it, and we can start from there. So
no worries, but go ahead.
So I met Alex when I think it was a couple of years ago. I feel like it was during the pandemic, when we were at that workshop in DC, organized by Dr. Timnit Gebru. And Dr. Suresh, and his last name I can never pronounce correctly. Do you know Dr. Suresh?
Venkat Subramanian, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
so this was, and I'm gonna do an intro inside of an intro. So these two figures that organized this workshop that Alex and I met at are two big figures in the conversation right now about technology and society. One of them, Dr. Suresh, was involved with the White House and the writing of the AI Bill of Rights. Dr. Timnit Gebru, and I think Alex will likely expand on this later, but a leading figure right now in the conversation on technology and justice, technology and ethics, formerly was at Google. There was a big report and study that she put out that I don't think Google liked. Their version of the story is that well, I don't know what their version of the story is, but I know from my version of the story of the algorithms that were coming out of Google, and they couldn't handle that from a scientist inside. So I met you there, Alex. If you recall, I think we had a lunch mm-hmm. together.
Yeah.
And I've been following your work, and in my eyes and in the eyes of many of my students at Northwestern and across the country, Dr. Hanna is a leading voice right now on questions of AI and society, AI and ethics. I know you have a new book coming out that I hope you can share a little bit about. Director of research formerly at DARE, the Distributed AI Research Center that was founded by Dr. Timnit Gebru after she left Google, and just up to good trouble. I see you on the internet engaging in public pedagogy and education. And one thing I really admire about you is actually, like, in part, we take inspiration from your podcast. So Dr. Mm-hmm. Hanna has a podcast called the Mystery AI Hype Theater. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, you missed the 3000, the Mystery AI Hype Theater. 3000.
Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah, obvious. Show, bro. Paying homage to the great Joel Hodgson and his crew of Motley Robots.
I love it. Yeah. And so that's a reason that I thought, like, not only are you doing really, really cutting edge work in the space, but you're also doing creative work in terms of the engagement beyond the halls of academia, which I think is really the essence of what we're doing here. So welcome. Welcome. And thank you so much for taking time to be here.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Thank you, Zephyr. That was a really kind and generous intro. So thank you very much.
It's from the heart.
I really appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I can contextualize a little bit too, because I mean, we're at this moment right now in the AI conversation, which, I mean, my kind of following and beat on comedians is that, you know, during the WGA strike last year, there's a lot of comedians that I knew that were, you know, they were working writers, they were working actors, and so a lot of the stuff that they were getting on was, you know, it became a lot of the contention was around the residuals from streaming services. Mm-hmm. But then from there, you know, there was this piece about AI where the producers are basically saying, well, we want to be able to explore AI in the writer's room. And the writers are like, well, hell no. Like, what does that even mean? And so when it comes down to brass tacks, what it ended up meaning a lot of the time was, you know, there would be people that would be writing things out, and we got a cat just came in. There would be, you always have to, that's a rule of our podcast. Whenever a cat comes in, you have to yell cat. And so whenever their producers would produce a trashy script, and they'd give it to the writers, and they'd say, okay, go ahead and fix this. And they would try to pay them at a much lower rate. When it would come to them, so they'd get kind of this hourly rate that'd be much less than if you were writing an original script. And so we kind of seen that in different kinds of creative industries over and over again. But we talked about that on the pod. We talked about that. You know, we've talked about it with a different number of different people.
The other person I host with the podcast and my co-author in the book is Emily M. Bender. So she was also a co-author on the paper, which to me, Dr. Timmy Giroux, it was at the center of the, it was at the center of the, center of her firing. She didn't get fired. She got resignated. She got told she was resigning, even though they said she was resigning. And then they made her resign for her, which, so we called her, she got resignated. And so that paper was definitely a part of it. You know, she had been very vocal at Google before that. And Google's excuses, you know, were ridiculous. Google, sorry, I'm cleaning my cat's eye out because
Alex, can you hold that thought? We're gonna jump into that. We just want to make sure we introduce David as well.
I'm sorry.
No, it's a format. It's like we do these long intros, and sometimes within the intro we already get started. So
It's on me.
But I want to give Mike a chance to introduce David, and then we're all just gonna dive in.
Right.
So,
yeah. In the vein of that same conversation, David, real quick, I'm definitely gonna give you your props in your intro. Don't expect those 8 syllable college words that Sapere was just using. I don't know them, but David, good comedy friend of mine. I've known him for years. I would say something that comes to mind when I think of David is he definitely shatters expectations. Like, you find out he's a teacher, it's going to shatter your expectations when you find out where and what he teaches. You find out he's a comedian, it's going to shatter your expectations when you find out where and what he does with his comedy. And he's ferocious. I am not in this classroom, although I should be, because I've been held back way too many times. But I do know that the way that he attacks the stage, the way that he presents himself in the comedy scene, if he's doing that whatsoever in his classroom, then he's one of the good ones when it comes to putting the fate and the mind of these young kids in somebody's hands. And I don't want to make it too long-winded because we got a lot to get to. This is an incredible topic, but somebody that that I really enjoy as a friend in comedy and overall a friend in life. But Dave, you could just also give a little quick for our listeners about yourself.
Yeah, thank you, man. I appreciate that. a lot of aggressive terminology. Well, very chill person, I feel. Yeah, he attacks life. No,
he
I just,
murders expectations.
I just vibe. My brother in Christ, I'm just vibing. I'm like mid-tier. No, I, yeah, I, I'm a high school teacher. I teach on the South Side in CPS right now. I teach English. I have,
what school?
I don't want to say it was cool just because it's podcast and privacy, gotcha. But
privacy issues. We don't care about privacy. We're not talking about privacy. Just kidding. Okay.
No, and it's a really good school. We're an international baccalaureate school and trying to kind of chase that dragon a little bit more this year. And I have sophomores and juniors and seniors this year. My junior and senior class is an IB like film class, so it's kind of like honors level film stuff that we're doing. So it's really cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've been there for a few years. I graduated college in the fall of 2019. And as soon as I graduated, I got a job in the district that I student taught in as a teaching assistant. So basically, I was hired as like a TA in January of 2020. And then the pandemic happened in March. So I was just kind of, I don't know, figuring it out. I directed like a fall play on Zoom. It was pretty lame, but we played, remember that game Among Us? So me and like 30 kids hopped on a Zoom call and played Among Us. And I just chopped up the footage of like them killing each other and having like jump scares and like face reacts. It was cool, man. But yeah, I am very excited to talk about AI in the classroom. I'm kind of like hands, you know, all hands on deck with my own AI and phone and technology in the classroom policies. Constantly changing, so it's cool to be here. Thanks for having me.
Dope.
Awesome.
To kind of circle back to what Alex was saying, and this is a question definitely for everybody on the panel, specifically Alex and Dave. And as a matter of fact, Sapere, you're in the classroom. You were talking, Alex, about like, you know, movie scripts and writers and bringing, everybody knows that. David, in the classroom, definitely you talk about kids that use it. And in the comedy world, nobody talks about it, but we know what's up, right? And I heard a thought experiment before. Somebody said, and this, some whoever smart person that's from back in the day, said if you have a ship, right, the Black Pearl, and then every time you dock it, you take some pieces away, like some wood and the mast and the sail and da 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 da, and over time, after however many years, you've made so many repairs that there's not a piece of original wood from the original ship. Is it the same ship? And I wonder about that with like AI. Like if you're using AI to write a paper, if you're using AI to write a script, if you're using it, but you start with human elements, at a certain point, is it still a human endeavor, or does it cross over into being like I would assume, David, like when you're telling students, hey, this is AI, like you're saying you did not put in an effort. But at what point in time was their effort stopped? Because AI didn't just spit it out for no reason, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the big question with AI in the classroom is exactly what you said, is you didn't put in the effort. And also, if, you know, there is an impediment to learning, like it's my kind of cardinal direction as an educator to fix that, right? 9 times out of 10 when a kid is using AI, it's either, well, I shouldn't say 9 times out of 10, but most of the time they're using it because they either A, don't want to like put in the productive struggle that it takes to complete you know, work and engage in an academic way, or B, there's a genuine impediment to the assignment and they figure, well, F it, I don't want to try to do the hard work of figuring out how to do this, let's just get this AI thing and use it to help me get this assignment and get a grade, right? So it's a lot of disengagement from the learning process when kids are relying on AI, both like as an active, I don't want to engage with the process because F the process, it doesn't matter, or B, I don't have time for the process.
Well, okay. Yeah. So were you going to jump in, Alex?
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, David, you're doing the hard work. You're a frontline teacher right now. I mean, you're actually dealing with kids that are pressed for time. And I mean, I'm in the classroom every so often. I teach at Cal sometimes. And I mean, but I hear from other people, you know, that they'll come in, and I had a friend of mine, she teaches at a community college up here called Chabot, and she had a student that was just it was a question that's like, why are you interested in photography? And it was, and then it literally, they copy and pasted the answer and it said, I'm a language model, I don't have any opinions about photography. I'm just like, you paste that at end, you didn't even.
That's just lazy. At least be smart if you're going to use it.
Yeah, at least have some creativity around it. And I thought that was ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, David's right. It's sort of like, what about this process can actually be engaging? You know, is it sort of people just say, I just want to get through this, I have other stuff to do. And I mean, it's sympathetic, especially the kids that are given like a lot of homework and stuff.
Okay, but challenge the presumption real quick, and just to play the other side of it real quick, because I'm in a classroom. I've seen some of the concerns that David, you have, I have with you know, undergraduates at Northwestern. But the question that pops to mind for me is, this is especially for David, being a high school teacher in CPS, are there positive use cases? Are you seeing other examples of kids using AI in really cool ways? Like, it's like, oh wow, like they're breaking some new territory, or is a prevalent trend kind of what we're talking about, which is people are using it as a shortcut? Is that mostly what it is, or is there some like interesting use cases that we should also be aware of?
Nah, dog, it's ass. It's it's pretty bad all around. I'd say the most productive use of AI is on the teacher end, where we've had a lot of productive conversations, I think, in our department meetings, where our department chair, I admit, has been really good about this. He's been like, I think maybe a year and a half ago, he started really bringing this conversation through, because he was like, listen, he teaches a theory of knowledge class. And he's like, my kids have to write a 10,000 word essay by the end of the year. And that has to go off and get evaluated by the International Baccalaureate Board. They're using AI to do this. So I think as a teaching staff, we have to be like, proactive about how we use AI in the classroom in order to show kids how to use it, right? Now, the difficulty with that, and I think it's a bigger idea, but showing kids how to use AI in a principled way is just another thing that teachers now have to do within the classroom and now have to teach. Because now you're essentially adding a whole new standard of like teaching elements in addition to the common core stuff that we're already trying to do, right? Like our basics is we're trying to get kids to write claims, get them to use evidence to support their claims, and then have analysis to explain their evidence, you know? Like you're telling me in betwixt all of that, I now have to include lessons or ideas or parts of my unit plans where it's like, okay, let's use AI in a really productive way. And honestly, I love my department chair. He's awesome, but he's also an older guy. He doesn't understand AI fully. And it was kind of Valen telling me, hey, you're young, figure it out. And I will say like the most, to go back to your question, the most productive use of AI is on the teacher end of it, because there are other young teachers like me in the building who are now trying to use it to trim down some of the responsibilities that we have as like high school teachers specifically in order to maximize our time. Because, for example, you know, our work day is about 7.5 hours long. 5 of those 7 hours we're teaching one-on-one, like instructing class.
Right.
3 of those hours in a day are supposed to be like prep periods. So if you do 3 times 5 days a week, that's 15 hours a week that we're supposed to be like prepping for class, right? Of those 15 hours a week, you probably have at least a meeting a day, and that cuts it down to 10. You know what I mean? And now I'm trying to have some sort of work-life balance. I don't want to be grading everything during the week, and then I get home on the weekend and all of a sudden I don't have anything planned, and now I got to scaffold all that out and differentiate all that stuff. So I'm trying to use AI in a productive way to skinny that up. The most recent example is this week in my English 2 class, we're teaching a unit on propaganda, and I was trying to make a quiz. So I had all these terminologies, all these different types of propaganda, like basically scattered throughout a bunch of different PowerPoints. So I went to Gemini on Google and I was like, hey, construct a very basic outline for a quiz with these terms, have some multiple choice, some short answer, because I didn't want to do the like strenuous work of individually copying and pasting all of these terminologies into a Word document, figuring out my own multiple choice questions, and then figuring out what order to put those questions
in. How were the questions in the sequencing? Were they pedagogically sound from a teacher's perspective?
Absolutely. Yeah. They were like not that bad. There was open response questions. I admittedly, like, I didn't give the AI a lot to work with because I was more so looking for like, give me the structure of a quiz so that I can do the individual editing, I can add the scaffolding in, I could rearrange things, right? I ended up deleting like half of the questions it gave me because they were just kind of repetitive. But the things that it left me with, I was like, oh, this is a really good cornerstone to build something that's going to fit into my classroom with the kids that I have, right? So it's that skinning up of like almost digital cleanliness that I feel like is rampant nowadays, where it's like we all have a Google Drive and that shit is not organized, you know? Like sometimes your Google Drive sucks, sometimes there's a billion emails, using AI to kind of take some ancillary data or ancillary terms and then organize it in a coherent way so that I can make tangible use of that, I think is probably the way that it's going to be right now the most productive in a high school setting.
That's where you see the opportunity. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I want to take a step back because I'm thinking about, so we're kind of talking about, you know, the potential for misuse of AI in terms of students taking shortcuts or even cheating. And that's part of the conversation, but I'm really thinking that we should have a broader conversation about the ethics of AI. And now I'm looking at you, Alex. You know I'm looking at you because you're working on a brand new book, and the research that you do with your colleagues at DARE has pushed a lot of new ground in terms of the way that these technologies are also part of the power structure. Right? Mm-hmm. They're not just made in a vacuum. They're actually made within Silicon Valley. It kind of dominates the space. And there's connections to, you know, not just the tech industry, but there's connections to war and militarism. There's connections to labor. I think we started off talking about, you know, the impact on art. There's a lot of questions that come up. Would you give us like a 10,000 foot view? Like if I'm talking to my mom about this, and I want to convince her that there's a bigger political structure at play, What's the way to introduce the kind of big picture, big ticket questions when it comes to questions of power, justice, race, et cetera, with respect to AI? How do we get into that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about the 10,000 foot view of it, you're kind of thinking about all the companies that own or are providing resources for AI tools are all the same ones that you already know. So it's Google, it's Microsoft, it's Amazon. I mean, OpenAI wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Microsoft and all the credits they provide. Anthropic wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Amazon. Basically, these are companies that are already in our day-to-day. And one of the kind of things that happens is that because these are the companies that are developing these tools, we have a centralization problem of power. I mean, we have a centralization of capital. So, I mean, not only, and so back in the day when we had, you know, when Microsoft was building technologies, they were doing things with, you know, they were controlling platforms basically because they had Microsoft Word and they had Windows, and they were basically the only game in town, right? We're going to package Internet Explorer with everything. And then they got hit by a huge antitrust suit in the EU, and then they couldn't put Internet Explorer. So Internet Explorer basically died.
What year was that, roughly?
What year was that? Was that in the 90s?
Okay.
Well, okay. Microsoft got deemed as a monopoly, and the government broke them up.
Well, they didn't get broken up, but they basically said you can't put Internet Explorer together with, and it can't be the only thing. I'm gonna search this because
let's search it. Let's
monopoly.
Figure it out.
But basically, so the U.S. versus MS is 2001.
Okay.
They basically said Microsoft had a monopoly of the web browser market for Windows. And so they broke it up. Internet Explorer is basically dead. They replaced it with kind of Edge. But now they have to include, you have to be allowed to use Google, Chrome, Firefox, etc. And so that was one way of basically establishing their market dominance. Now, the way that these companies are establishing market dominance is how much data they have and how much compute power they can control.
Right.
So these models don't exist unless they have shit tons of data. These models don't exist unless you have shit tons of computing power. So that's something that's different from 2001. But it's the same company in terms of Microsoft. Google is new since 2001, but they've been able to dominate because of search and their search product. And now they have an antitrust suit winding its way through the courts. I think the Department of Justice has just sued them for antitrust, along with a bunch of attorneys generals, a bunch of states. And then Amazon, which, you know, has its dominance through its logistics service, through Amazon and all this ordering, but they're also dominant in providing cloud computing. That's something I think fewer people know about. So any site that you use on the internet now probably has Amazon Web Services as part of its backbone. And so those two things, data and compute, basically control who has the means of AI, who has the means of computation. And so that's important when we talk about AI. I mean, it really focuses on who can steer the ship here, who's challenging regulation. We just had this regulation in California, which admittedly was a really stupid piece of legislation.
I saw that. It just got vetoed, right?
It just got vetoed. It got vetoed on the grounds that they said it would stem innovation, but it was challenged by all the big companies. But at the same time, that bill didn't go far enough, actually, I would say. That bill put very light kinds of guardrails around these companies that basically said, you have to certify your model for if it's this big.
Right.
And it didn't actually say, if your model actually is going to hurt these people or it's going to disempower these people, typically communities of color and poor people, it didn't say anything about that at all. But that's happening.
So that's bad. Yeah. So that doesn't bode well then, right? So if a bill that wasn't even, and you're telling it wasn't even, you know, that harsh on the tech industry, if that got vetoed, you know, by Governor Newsom in California. What does that foretell about the future of regulation in this industry? And we have an election coming up. So any thoughts? Kind of how do we think about, this is a question that's been coming up the last couple episodes, but are there big differences between a potential presidency under Kamala Harris versus a Trump in terms of AI regulation?
There's lots of stuff that can be done in the executive, but at the same time, the executive can only do so much. The biggest change I would see that if there was a President Trump administration is that certain regulatory agencies would be disempowered. So one of the agencies that's probably doing the best stuff around AI right now is the Federal Trade Commission. The Federal Trade Commission basically is an area of the government. It's a regulatory agency where they could effectively say, are you basically scamming people? Are you not offering a product that actually says what it can do, does what it can say? Are you violating people's privacy? Well, we're going to hit you with a regulatory action. We're going to hit you with a pretty big fine. So for example, last week, the FTC hit up this company that was called Do Not Pay. They hit them with a fine that was, I think it was $139,000. And what they basically said was Do Not Pay was basically like, look, you get in an accident or you have some kind of legal thing that you have to deal with, type in, you know, to our chatbot, I got hit with this accident or I got hit with this fine. I don't want to pay the ticket. And it'll generate some kind of a legal brief that you go and take to your, whatever, your district court or whatever, and without even having to hire a lawyer. They got hit with that because it can't actually do that. It can't actually do any of those things. If you show up with a legal brief written by Do Not Pay, you're fucked, man. Like, it's actually, it's going to get you in big trouble. It might produce court cases that don't exist.
And this is under the leadership of the FTC chair, Lina Khan, right?
Yeah,
And she's been in the news a lot lately. She was the one I sent you guys a link recently. She was in conversation with Hasan Minhaj.
Yeah.
Just a few days ago. So I've been watching her. She's been going pretty hard from what I understand against the tech industry. Yeah. But are they gonna keep her if Kamala wins? We don't know, right?
Well, I mean, the hope is that they do.
Yeah.
But you know, under a Trump presidency, you better believe that she's gone. And, you know, and that's also with other regulatory agencies like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that Senator Warren started. You could see probably a disempowered Equal Opportunity Commission. You could also probably see kind of defanging of the National Labor Relations Board. So it does have pretty important implications for what kind of regulation can come about. Legislation-wise, like what Congress has been doing, I mean, they haven't been doing much. Senator Schumer had a series of these forums and put out a weak sauce report with absolutely no actual roadmap. And that's with Democrats in charge of the Senate. So I don't have a lot of faith in the legislative process, but regulation is probably going to be where we see more and more of this stuff happening. And that's definitely going to can be really much directed by who's at the top.
It's striking me as odd that, I mean, legislation at some point, right? But this is the tip of the spear. Like, this is the cutting edge. It's happening. It's happening, like, as we speak, right? There's new changes every day. Something about what you were saying earlier, Alex, I believe it was not only the monopoly for Microsoft in regards to the internet, but it was also more so in regards to their processing chips at the time. I think they talk about it and only the paranoid survive. And that was why the government had to like stop them from only distributing it to the computers that, and correct me if I'm wrong, the computers that are in their particular network. And I mean, my question is, I guess, because you see a lot of that right now with NVIDIA, right? Mm-hmm. NVIDIA is part of that Magnificent Seven that is basically propping up U.S. stock market as a whole. And what I'm wondering about for everybody on here is, where does the where does the goalpost get moved to next? And why is this the particular point that we're stopping it now, right? At one point in time, it was an abacus in the classroom to do math. Then they came out, Texas Instruments came out with something called a calculator. And people were like, ah, we're going to forget how to use an abacus. And then it got moved up to cell phone. Well, at some point in time, it went to the dweebs that had the calculator watch, right? Then it got moved up to cell phone.
Hey, I have a calculator watch.
Now it's cool. Now it's cool.
It depends on when you have it.
But you had, to be, you, now you had to,
when I saw people with the calculator watch, I was like,
oh, back in the 80s, early 90s, you was a savage if you had one of those. A Seiko?
Yes.
Oh, come on. You was a savage. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that so
it my, all the Iranian uncles with the hairy forearms. Shout out all the Iranian hairy forearms.
Yeah. What's up?
But now, if it always moves up a tick and the processes get easier, more facile for people to work with, right? Why are we now saying, all right, the goalpost is AI? Now we gotta keep traditional before when every generation before us for not only this but just about anything.
Mike, I
can actually hop in. I feel like I know where you're going. And to answer that, I'll say change is very slow and then all at once.
Yeah.
Right? With everything, change is so slow and then all at once. And I think in terms of education and AI in the classroom specifically, the prospect of it being kind of everywhere is on the table, but I still think we're a far ways out because people are still having conversations like this where we're like, I don't know, AI is kind of ass. It's just a language acquisition model. It's just making an educated guess and spitting things out back at you, hoping that you understand and can make meaning of it. You know what I mean? Right now, in my classroom, for example, I take my kids' phones and I put them in a Faraday bag. Like, they're not getting nothing. They're getting Bluetooth cut off. They're getting mad at me that their songs are cutting out. I'm like, it's because you got me for 50 minutes. You don't got to listen to Lil Durk right now. Like, that is what it is, you know? And there is, at least in the short time that I've been in education, a sentiment that spans across a lot of educators where we are like, not only do we need to get phones out of classroom, but like now you're talking about trying to add AI to the classroom. Like these are just distractions that are inherently, I think, bad for learning, especially, and this is the way that I frame it to my students. They're like, well, why can't we read our books on a screen? Or why can't we do work on our phones or on a Chromebook? And what I tell them is I'm like, the human brain evolved over thousands of years to write with like pen and paper, essentially. Screens are a design and an invention that's only been around for like 80, 90 years at max. Like all of the research shows that you guys are going to learn better with pen to paper no matter what we're doing. So my goal is to make you learn as best as you can doing what evolutionarily works the best right now. Maybe in 300 years, humans will have evolved in some way to like remember things better on a screen than they will on pen.
Well, okay, David, I have a question for you then. Because I agree with you intuitively. I'm the same way. I have three young kids at home, and I'm trying to delay technology. I think on a gut level, I agree with you. But what about the question of what's the responsibility of schools to prepare kids to enter into a world where AI is definitely part of that world, right? So it's shaping culture, it's shaping the economy, it's shaping military. It's like it's doing all kinds of damage to the environment, and so it's part of their world. People are using it. It's integrated in workflows. So I hear you on what does the science of learning tell us about best pedagogy, best methods for student engagement, motivation, and et cetera. But don't schools have a responsibility to teach kids about the world as it is? And isn't that world include AI? How do you think about that question?
Dude, that's a great question. I'm going to say no. Hot take.
Okay.
Whoa.
Okay.
Sound the alarms.
No, they do not.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Why?
Because specifically for AI. Because in the same way, I'm going to take this and kind of like use an analogy. When I was becoming in school to become a teacher, right, I had, you know, a decent like education program at Illinois State, go Redbirds, but it was public school, you know, like I was a communication education major, last guy to graduate from my program, then they killed it for money and funding. Education, being a high school teacher, is such a learn on the fly profession, and you really don't understand how to be in front of kids and how to design good lessons and be flexible and responsive until you've been doing it for a long time. And I'm feeling that right now. I am in year four of being a teacher, and I feel like this is the year that I've been the most behind the eight ball because I've had basically new classes thrown my way, and I am building curriculum as I go. I think with AI, that's the exact same thing of how it applies in the real world. Like, you can do a lot of studying and figuring out how to use AI in the best way that you can in undergrad. But until you are in a workplace environment and you know exactly what demands are needed of you, you can't really, there's no way to teach kids how to better use AI until they know what they need to use it for. My best example of this is one of my best friends. He's one of the head of marketing at the card game company, What Do You Meme, right? Mm. And he was in town for a little bit, and we were hanging out, and we were just on the bus one day, and he pulls up his phone. And I was like, dude, what are you doing? You're just like clicking a bunch of buttons. Like, it looks like you're playing a game right now. He's like, no, I'm working. And I was like, well, how? And he's like, well, we basically had the Slack channel with a bunch of like aggregate data and things where we were trying to figure out different deadlines for different marketing projects. And he's like, I basically took that aggregate data, plugged it into an AI model, and helped it streamline it so that we could easily identify what deadlines were coming up for what specific projects and what needed to happen next. And I was like, that's awesome, because there's no way that I could teach a kid, hey, use AI to do this, to aggregate data so that it makes your work life easier. That's like something that is so specific to the demands at hand for a specific job. So to answer the question, like, is it beholden of educators to show kids like what happens in the real world? Yeah, for sure. But at the end of the day, every kid's world that they experience post-secondary education is vastly different. I'm going to have a lot of kids go to four-year universities. I'm also going to have a lot of kids go to a trade school, right? I'm going to have a lot of kids go to a four-year university, fuck around, find out, drop out, go to community college, right?
And that's why education is so hard. We have to figure out what is the foundational level, like what are the basics that everyone needs regardless of where they end up.
Exactly. And I think my argument would be that the basics of AI in this, I think, moment are not really meaningful for a lot of people. I think there's a lot of like white collar yapping about AI where we're like, oh yeah, how does it make my email sound not mean to my boss because he has a superiority complex or whatever. But I think it's so job specific, it is so job dependent, and it's so profession dependent, right? As a comedian, like, I don't use AI at all because it's a creative endeavor. Like, that is inherent to it. And I think there are comics that I know that have used AI in the past, and I'm gonna be honest, the jokes ain't funny, right? Now maybe AI it's gives
really,
them
really unfunny.
Yeah, it sucks, right? And I think this might be a side column, but like, AI is being used to, I think, mitigate or achieve creative outcomes instead of trying to like fix the menial bullshit that most people deal with in their everyday lives. And I see that as an educator, and I'm like, well, people are trying to use AI to create stuff, because in terms of Bloom's taxonomy and the skills that you ask kids and students to do, like, creation is the top of that like pillar.
Right.
Like, to make something from nothing or to use prior experience, ideas, and knowledge to then create a new perspective or a new outcome is one of the hardest things that the human mind does. And because it's so hard and you're functioning at such a high gear when you do that mentally, that's why people are trying to use AI to do that. So trying to, you know, if I'm as an educator and I'm like, I want to build a better world with the kids that I have now, like, I'm not going to show them how to use AI successfully, because at the end of the day, they got to know the basics of like reading, writing, analysis, and arithmetic. And that is a good enough foundation for them to figure out AI later.
Now, real quick,
and David, I've been trying to get in with this point because I wanted to start. No, it's okay. No, it's good. You're the actual teacher. I just fake being a teacher sometimes. And then, so I mean, one thing that Mike said that I want to bring up too is about what the tools are in the classroom. So it was the abacus. And then, I don't know, people are probably complaining about the abacus. I don't know who's complaining about the abacus. Aristotle. And then,
calculator.
Shout out Pythagoras. And then there's the calculator. You could only use a four-function calculator, a TI-83, which for some reason still are $100.
that is a problem.
Texas Instruments has calculator arbitrage on lockdown. I don't know. You could be having for 10 years ago, it'd still be $100 somehow. But the funny thing is that we're kind of going backwards, right? So there's actually, you know, the funny thing about large language models and like ChatGPT, it actually can't do math. Like, you know, this is actually, so there's a paper that came out, I was finding at this University of Waterloo professor. If you get beyond, so GPT-4o, which is literally OpenAI's like biggest,
that's their most recent one,
their
right?
Most recently,
it
once you get beyond multiplying digits with three, basically three and three, like, or three and four, like it basically goes to zero. It actually just can't. It gives you a fake answer. You know, it just gives you an answer that exists. Imagine asking it to multiply like 1.3567 times 3. You know, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5, but it just makes up shit, right? Because it can't do math, right? And so the thing about a calculator, it's accomplishing a very specific narrow task. And most people in their daily lives are not using graphing calculators, unless you have students that go into engineering, or you have people that are doing some fun partial differential equations. I don't know what graphing calculators actually can do. But what if you're actually just kind of adding something, it becomes a tool. And like David was saying, it becomes a pretty well-scoped tool. Basically, you're doing this particular task that is really well-scoped. What these AI tools are doing now is that they're promising to do everything, right? They're saying we need to basically say it's gonna come up with an idea, it's gonna write jokes, it's going to write a script. It can't do any of those things, or it can do them very poorly. It looks trashy, it looks janky. But it's because these tools aren't really identified as something that's narrowly scoped. So his friends that works at the card game, I mean, it's a pretty well-scoped kind of thing that might be really applicable for the job. And I don't think it's really the kind of thing where you're sort of saying it's not really a like a linear path from abacus to calculator, or I guess we had slide rules.
Now, like, what came those in between? I feel like a lot of time went by between the abacus and the
slide rule. My dad, who was an engineer, he had a slide rule, and I was like, "How the fuck do you work this thing?" Like, I never was taught how to use that, but it's actually very cool when you actually figure it out. And then calculator, right? And then I mean, okay, calculator. And then sometimes in school, you're like, okay, no calculators on this because we want you actually to show your arithmetic. But then, okay, arithmetic is something we have an assumption that you've mastered. Let's now do this, you know, and let's do this another way. Now we want you to master how to solve an integral. And I'm pretty sure most calculators can't solve an integral unless they're like, yes, Wolf or Malfram or whatever. And it's a pretty narrow, so it's more of a scope on task rather than sort of thinking about what this thing, whether it's supposed to supplant kind of a particular sort of thinking. I mean, I think there's things that are evergreen that we teach our students. And, you know, if we kind of seed that territory to an AI tool and say, it's going to do the thinking for us. Well, first off, it doesn't think. So no, it's not. And then you're missing out on incredible teaching opportunities.
Can I ask you, Alex, from my understanding, coming from the tech world, Sapir, coming from the higher education world, David, coming from the minds being molded into who the future is going to be. I have the feeling and belief that it's a matter of time, right, before it crosses that uncanny valley and it becomes aware. All this effort and getting put into it, it feels like that's what people are going for. Assuming that does happen one day, and they create an actual general artificial intelligence.
What does it look like from there?
I didn't ask my question yet, Dave, but I appreciate it.
I was just going to say that I reject the premise of the question. I don't think they're not going to build that. It's bullshit.
It's not going to happen ever,
but with the current models, and not, I'm not saying that the current generation of models, I'm not saying it's a matter of scale. I'm saying that the current strategy, what they're trying to do is that they're using a metaphor of the brain to say that we're building a brain. That's not happening. These
Well,
are really.
I'm not talking about specifically what's happening in an office somewhere where they're clicking away on a keyboard to make something. I'm talking about the year 2024, before I die, hopefully somewhere in the year 3033, that they will create general artificial. What's my life actuary table? It's multiplied. It keeps going up. I drink green juice once every
say,
3 years.
Can I get your green juice recipe? I don't know if I want to die in 3033, but I mean, I'll at least get me over to 2100.
All right, is it feasible to believe that in our lifetime, the lifetime of the people that are on this call right now, that a general artificial intelligence, something that does not need outside information in order for it to come up with its own processes?
Alex says no, and I tend to agree, but I think David wanted to.
You're good. I was gonna say no, but I bet it would happen like the day after I die.
Certainly
like,
will.
That's probably what. Like, I'm gonna be like, dude, hell no. And then it's like one day later, it's like, dude, this thing achieves sentience. It's like, fuck.
You can't be mad about it. You're dead though.
That's true. I mean, I could be like post mortem mad. You know.
I'll be mad that I won't be able to see Fast and Furious 29.
Yeah.
No, family is everything.
An inch or a mile.
I was gonna say, with all of that, I think the biggest thing, so I'm a big sci-fi guy, like I really loved the Halo video game series growing up, if you guys are familiar with that. And I remember growing up watching Halo, because Cortana, which I think is the Microsoft AI that they have modeled after or have named her after, was this like ethereal figure growing up. They made her like way too sexy for no reason, but the idea of like an AI that is on a essentially tiny computer chip that can help navigate ships and do everything in the year, you know, 2500 was like so novel to me. But the thing that I take away from that now as an adult is the interfaces that we have are so prehistoric for the conversations that we're thinking about. Like, people are like, oh, when is AI going to be sentient, and when can I have a conversation with it and have it help me fix things in my life and organize things and drive a car? And it's like, dude, you're working on a Dell laptop. You know what I mean? Like, do you know how fundamentally limiting that is? Like, I think most people have this conception of like AI is going to be there for a lot of things to help you exponentially grow and be better, when it's like, no, I'm just kind of on a web page on my laptop punching things in. It doesn't feel anything crazy. Like, to me,
which is magical to me, David. You're saying it like I'm used to it because it's been around for majority of my life. Punching things on a computer and playing a video game Fair. In high definition is magical.
So I'm thinking like pure
Isaac Asimov has been talking about it since the Foundation series, since way back in the day.
I know.
I still don't think scientists to this day can define consciousness. How can we say that a computer can't achieve something that scientists can't even actually define for us?
When I read the Foundation series, it's awesome, by the way. What envision in my head is, if it's in my classroom, like my regular classroom, my regular desks, the only thing that would make AI work is having like six screens everywhere that I could tangibly take like a fake glove and like throw PDFs on, so that kids can cross compare texts and like cross analyze things at the same time. Because the idea right now of having like a single screen in which AI helps you like spit something out is so rudimentary that it's like it's bogus. And like Hannah said earlier in the podcast, it's just like a way for people to collect and like rake in data so that they have some sort of foreseeable business model. You know what I mean?
Okay. I mean, I don't know if it's an interface thing though. I mean, so okay, I grew up on Star Trek, and I'm a big Trekkie, and so much of the computer, there's two interfaces that come up. And to be honest, some of the interfaces don't really seem too different from what we have now. One of them is very different. One of them was not. The first one is the audio system, where they say computer, blah, blah, blah. You basically have something like that right now, right? I can say to my phone, usually I'm telling it to play a podcast or give me directions to Home Depot.
Hey, Siri, pull up the next episode of PCWB.
Yeah. 2001 A Space Odyssey nailed a lot of stuff too.
Kubrick.
And so interfaces for one, but the kind of more complicated one is Lieutenant Commander Data in Star Trek. You know, so he's an android. he's embodied. He's a personification. He literally has a brain that he calls a neural network, you know, of the kind of model, which is, you know, an old term. You know, the next generation came out in 1988, and neural network is a term that's been around since, I think, the 40s. So it's a pretty old term, right? And so, to some degree, the interface, you know, is the interfaces are sort of there. I think the kind of thing that is, you know, like, and I don't know if, I don't know that they classify the computer as necessarily a, the computer, the vocal computer is necessarily an AI agent. I think they kind of say it's a, they call it computer. But then Lieutenant Commander Data is supposed to be this sort of AI agent insofar as he has quote unquote thoughts or consciousness. Now, I will say this, it's a very philosophical question to ask what and what is consciousness.
Johnny and... Five said it. Johnny it is. Five is alive. Short circuit it, nailed it.
There it is.
Front
there
back.
It is. Identification. Is that it? Yeah. Well, I mean, mismeasure man or measure of man gets just mentioned a lot in the episode. TNG episode, I don't know, I'm not going to rattle the season episode off the top of my head. I'm not that nerdy. But then
well, you are a genius though, Alex. Who said I think therefore I am?
That's
dude, that was me last week.
Yeah, that's why I voted for you, bro.
I said it. Yeah, ergo cognito sum. That's Descartes. Yeah. And then the if you want to go back, your initial reference of the ship, it's the ship of Theseus, the original. Yeah.
Look at this
and
guy.
So,
I knew it.
And so, but I mean, the idea is coming from here is saying the way we can talk about consciousness all we want, but this idea of intelligence and this idea of what is intelligent has a really grisly history, right? I mean, because it's the original, it's one
say
of the
more, say more.
Yeah, it's the original eugenic sin, right? About intelligence and who is fully a human and who has fully in mind, right? And so now what we're having now in the current day is that the same arguments that are being made about who is intelligent and who is not intelligent, or if a robot should have rights, you know, you have the kingdom of you have freaking Saudi Arabia granting Sophia the robot rights, and with an ironic that women can't drive, and you have that full irony right there. Eugenics basically was saying that people in early 19th century Britain that were mentally disabled, that they weren't fully human, you know, and said that they should be euthanized, they should be sterilized and not euthanized, or they should be kept in, you know, hospitals. Same thing with how they've been establishing a hierarchy of races, and saying that basically white people are at the top and that black people are at the bottom. I mean, this is the way this kind of testing of intelligence has been used. So you might not even have kind of consciousness.
So that, and that history is wrapped up in the history of the development of AI, is what
absolutely,
you're saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Uh-huh. It absolutely is. I mean, that's been, it's like, well, let's try to define what intelligence is. Well, you can't really get into the measure of intelligence without talking about that dark history and how it replicates itself, especially as we're trying to evaluate what it means to have that. So, I mean, I know this is like a big detour on sort of thinking about what
it's relative. So intelligence is relative, and that answer is definitely relative. And I appreciate everybody's perspective on it. What, if any, is the responsibility of a company creating a AI, I don't know the technical terms they use for the language models and whatnot, what responsibility do they have of saying, okay, this is just an open perspective, this is just going to answer based on data that we pull from everywhere, versus this is how I think, this is what I do, this is my beliefs, my values, and it's also going to be input into my AI. So when you come to my, it's like, I think all of us can agree, if you're going to watch a news channel, depending on what channel you're tuning into, you kind of have a vibe on what kind of news you're going to get. Do these creators have a responsibility of making these large language models general, or is it, hey,
and can they?
They're making
and even can they?
Yeah,
right, is that even it, is that even possible? Yeah. So let me can I build on that question, because that's kind of intersects with where I'm at. I want to make sure I understand David's perspective and Alex's perspective, and then see if we can find some kind of consensus between us, or we're just disagreeing. I'm not sure. But from David, what I found really interesting about what you said as a teacher in CPS is that you're actually experimenting with AI, and where you see the most excitement and utility is actually in the logistics aspect of your work. And I heard someone else about like 6 months ago who's doing a lot of work around AI and the military. And the question the reporter asked was, where do you see the biggest value add for AI in the military? And the response was kind of surprisingly in logistics. And like a lot of things that we don't think of, not in the very creative, innovative space, but in the area of logistics. I think that's what I hear in what you're saying, David. But I also hear you saying, look, it's a waste of time to teach kids how to use AI or how to do prompt engineering, as some people call it. It's a fast moving ecosystem, and they'll figure it out when they get there, right? In the meantime, in between time, I'm going to see how I can use it to improve some aspects of my teaching, especially given how much is on teachers' plates, right? And shout out to all teachers at CPS and everywhere, because we know that they're overworked. And from Alex, that's what I hear in your perspective. From Alex, I hear a perspective like, look, the politics of AI are really, you know, crooked, right? There's a concentration of power in a small number of companies, and they're in it for the bottom line. There's a big hype cycle around what AI can do. And I agree with you 100% that the idea of artificial intelligence is based on an unscientific notion of what learning even looks like. I can say that as someone who's in a department of learning sciences, right? Like the most advanced theories of cognition and learning and intelligence are actually very disconnected from the most advanced large language models. There's a disconnect between the science of learning and the theories of learning that undergird a lot of the current technologies that we see. But the question that I didn't hear either of you address is this: if we're sitting here talking about even having the conversation about sentience, Mike, you brought up consciousness. The very fact, now Alex might say not going to happen, but the fact that it's a question to begin with, I think, is significant. Mm. And we haven't even touched on the very real environmental questions that AI models and the compute power raise. So I bring the question all the way back to David, and not to put you, on the spotlight, I guess it's for all of us, given how important AI is, not to use AI. I'm not saying important to use it, not AI literacy in that regard, but given how important AI is for the environment, for questions of consciousness, for questions of democracy, don't schools have a responsibility to engage students in the ethics of AI in that realm? Or is it still, they'll get to it when they can? I guess I'm struggling to kind of square those two things. Yeah, I agree with you, David. We don't need to teach them how to use AI, but don't I need to teach them that like there's a handful of companies, not me personally, but we as a society, that, you know, there's like real danger in terms of, you know, nuclear weapons, in terms of the environment, and maybe some possibilities that are possible. Shouldn't they be clued into that conversation?
Absolutely. So I'll tackle this from two different ways. One, I'll start with like a broad technology answer. One of my good friends, who was one of my speech coaches in college, his son is about 11 or 12 right now. And he and I were having a conversation one day, because I was like, yeah, I collect my students' phones at the door. Phones are generally bad for your kids. And he was like, you know, my wife and I had a conversation where we were going to not get my son a smartphone. And then we decided to do it anyway. And I was like, well, why? And he was like, well, because for me, if internet is going to be a thing for his entire like life, from, you know, baby to like death, right, in some way, shape or form, he's like, I feel like it's incumbent upon me as a responsible parent to coach him through that and coach him through those interactions. And he basically told me this short little story where he was like, yeah, we were at dinner one day and I told him to put his phone down. We were at dinner at his parents' house or something like that. And I was like, put your phone down. And he was like, no. And he pulled his son aside and was like, hey, listen, having a conversation with someone like grandpa who you might not be able to connect with right away is difficult, but building those skills over time, it becomes easier. Your phone is just a distraction from that. And it's going to feel awkward. You should feel awkward because it is new, right? And I think that idea of like, the awkwardness of AI and specifically like learning language acquisition models is difficult to build into the classroom because it's so new. And I say that to tie it into my second answer to your question, which is I'm at an international baccalaureate school. So, right, our context is like we're operating under the schema of international baccalaureate like systems and standards. And one of the things that we always try to do is whatever unit we're designing or whatever we're teaching, we're trying to connect it to a global context, right? Something that is happening like writ large in the world. If you're unfamiliar with international baccalaureate, it's basically an idea where any international baccalaureate school is you're learning the same skills and standards across the world. So the kids in, you know, French international baccalaureate schools versus American schools or South Asian schools, they're all learning the same skills and standards no matter what language it is being taught in or what content is being taught. And a part of those global contexts is like the things that you're saying, like climate change, better health, security, mental health, things like technology, which would be AI. So, and there is
I
some
gotcha.
relevancy to your question to say, shouldn't we be teaching our kids about this, that it matters, that there's these big ass companies doing these somewhat shady things? Yeah, there is. That is the story of America, right? Really big companies doing weird, shitty things. And then I'm just like some 27-year-old kid who's like, tough, like, let's figure it out, you know?
Right.
So that's kind of built into the idea of it as an IB World School. And I'll add a third answer before I close by saying, the internet that the kids are growing up on now is so platform centric that they have no that when the I you know I'm 27, I grew up with the internet and its evolving kind of spaces. They're growing up on top of the internet, right? So unless, which AI might do this, I don't know, but unless something is built further on top of the internet that they
That's
already
interesting.
exist on, right? Not much is going to change in their everyday lives. And if it's not going to change that much, then it doesn't warrant being addressed in a high school classroom in that way when kids are like, what does superfluous mean? You know what I mean? And that's like my main job is trying to show them, like, hey, no, Romeo and Juliet is about you. Like, it's okay. Like, y'all ever have a sneaky link? That's the whole story, you know? Like, these are things that are like,
And your families hate each other.
yeah, your families hate each other. Like, you ever get yelled at by your uncle, dude? That's what happens.
Where's he from? The West Side.
Yeah. Like, these are all things that matter way more in a practical, tangible, on the ground way. And especially
I hear
like
that.
to go back to it too, AI is a language acquisition model. I am a language teacher. Like, if the kids don't know the fucking words, it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? And that's the ultimate goal, I think, of most, or at least I hope most high schools right now. So I hope that answered your
It
question. It's
does.
kind
It
of a
does.
bunch of
I
different
mean,
things.
basically, you were saying that everything I said was correct. So I appreciate the validation. Thank you for that. No, but okay, on that same note, Mike, I'm sorry. I feel like I've been asking a lot of questions. I've been geeking out on this. I'm teaching a
Go for it.
class right now at Northwestern called AI and Education. I'm co-teaching it with PhD student Charles Logan. So shout out to him if he's listening to the podcast. And I know he is because he's a big fan of Dr. Hannah. So hey, Charles, how's it
I've
going?
got I have gotten a few messages for I owe him an email or two.
But let me ask, let me give you a chance, Alex, to speak on your new book. There's a lot of hype around it, no pun, because your book is about AI hype and trying to
Yes.
you know, it's coming out with Dr. Emily Bender, I believe, being published by Harper Books. Is it coming out in the spring, or how soon can we expect it?
It's coming out in spring, May 13th, 2025, and you
Cool.
should be able to pre-order it sometimes. I was just talking, my agent told me to pub we should plug it as much as possible starting right now,
So
so
what's the plug? Give me the here's your moment. What's the quick plug? And then if you can link it for my own personal satisfaction to education, that would be amazing because I'm gonna love the book on its own. And then I'm gonna think, I'm obsessed with what's happening in schools and out of school programs. What aspects or concepts from the book and from your research should David be teaching in his class, even though he refuses to do so?
Yeah. What? Damn. Why are you doing like
kidding.
that?
I'm just
Yeah, I mean the book is called The AI Con, and the full name is The AI Con: How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the World We Want. And the idea behind it is, you know, we talk about what AI is, what AI hype is. Basically, AI hype is a way of companies telling you, if you don't get in on this, you're going to miss out. It's fear of missing out. We talk about how language models in particular work, how this current round of AI works. Because AI is not just one thing. I mean, it's kind of incoherent. We say AI, but we basically mean large language models in this context. So we talk about how those actually work and why it gives us the illusion like it's understanding anything. It's not. It's kind of a parlor trick. We talk about the history, like we were saying, about general intelligence and its racialized history. And we talk about how it's affecting the workplace, how it's affecting workers, that's how it's trying to go after our jobs, even though it's not going to replace us. But the threat is that it can replace you and do your work. And then we do talk about education. We talk about AI and education and healthcare and in social services. So in education, we talk about, you know, the promise that these things are going to actually replace the important work that teachers do. And, you know, whether that's about, you know, teaching critical skills or doing the marking or whatever. And there's this example of these kids in the UK in which it was, I think, the first year of COVID, and they had said, you know, they had been taking their A-level exams. And that's like, it's kind of like their SATs. It kind of determines everything that happens after, you know, after they leave high school. And they eventually had an algorithm. They didn't call it AI. They had an algorithm grade all the exams, and it graded everybody dramatically lower. And so these students got so mad in the UK, they went to 10 Downing Street, basically, you know, where the prime minister sits, and they were chanting, "Fuck the algorithm," outside of his door. So, I mean,
wow.
Yeah. And so these promises of kind of AI tutors or whatever is happening all over. And it's especially going hand in hand with all the data that they're collecting out of all these systems now. Sephir, I know you met my colleague, Adrian Williams, who, you know, she used to be a charter school teacher. And she talked about this prior to even the current AI rush, about how all these CMSs, all these content management systems that are, or curriculum management systems that they were using, they were asked to put in so much data into those systems about the students and what they were doing. So everything about this kind of interaction, that's that the important work that David's doing in his classroom, that you're doing in your classroom, this is connective work. There's so much that can't be quantified or can't be completely automated away. I mean, why would you want to do that? That's the important stuff. That's the good stuff.
Right,
right. Stuff we like to do, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of idea. It's that there's this way that a lot of the ways that the companies are envisioning this stuff is that they're saying, put everything in this text box. You know, we'll give you a lesson plan. We'll make marking easier, make grading easier, all this other stuff. So we talk about education in the book. We talk about healthcare. We talk about nursing, where nursing is under a huge amount of threat from these tools. They think they can replace nurses in hospitals by offering like a voice, like a Cortana or whatever. Whatever.
But you're saying the threat itself is hyped. So
yeah,
so
the
we shouldn't
threat is,
so we shouldn't be as worried as people are saying.
I would say you shouldn't be worried about this thing taking your job. You should be worried about your boss believing that it can take your job. And that's where you're fretting. I mean, give the book to your boss.
The worry is not. I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there not anything scary about, like, worrying about the computer by itself? No, not really. But aren't they putting this stuff in human beings, flawed human beings' brains? Aren't they actively working on that right now? Like, hey,
no, I don't think they are. No? I think there's
Elon, richest man in the world, isn't working on putting computers in people's brains.
Mike's like, fuck that.
Is that? Wait, am I wrong? You said no, Alex.
There's Neuralink. Neuralink is slightly different. That's not necessarily AI. It's a brain computer interface,
which can plug into something, right? It's not going to get an update.
I mean, well, hopefully they should update that firmware. I would hope so, but I don't think that they're actually trying to put AI in. I think it's more like, I think the way it works, and this is way
it plugs into Wi-Fi. It's the same thing to me, Alex. I'm not gonna lie.
Hey,
bro, you don't plug into Wi-Fi, you fucking boomer. Listen,
just because you're plug 27, in, connect
semantics. That's called sophistry, David. Won't you put that in your syllabus for next year?
Hey, bro, I've seen your house. You don't have any green juice in that bitch. It's
gonna be a while. No, but are they not making? That's basically a cybernetic entity, right? When you have human beings that are integrated with computer technology, that's what they're doing right now, right?
Yeah, but we do that anyway, to an extent, but not
I can play chess with my eyeballs.
I mean, on sort the of. Internet. You can sort of do that with the eye tracking technology. That's not AI. That's the thing. This is a point we make in the book. Like, you can't call this shit all AI. It's not all AI. Like, it's just like AI is like a statistical model, or rather, there's so many different flavors of AI. There's the same thing that gets called, there's a statistical model that makes a decision whether something in an image is a cat or a dog. They call that AI the same way they call, you type in, I want Master Chief, like in
fill in the blank.
Riding Yoshi instead of Mario, like whatever, that's a different. That's a sort of different AI, or like that's a diffusion model. It still gets called AI. And then there's like a recommendation system that, you go on Spotify and they call that AI too. It's not, I mean, it's got like, this is all a marketing term to call something AI. So it becomes conceptual slippage.
Yeah.
And it's the argument, I mean, this is one argument we make in the book, is the argument's basically being made, the machine is very good at playing chess, therefore it's going to tell me how to do my homework. That's actually not, they're different programs. They're different technologies. I mean, it's a very old move to do this too. They were doing this in the 70s when the US and the Soviets were making chess playing machines.
Sure.
They were basically
IBM saying, was famous for doing it, and they did it on Jeopardy, and they did it.
That's right.
IBM playing it.
They had Deep Blue beat Kasparov, famous, it was a whole thing. And they said, like, oh, our machine is smarter than this. And so it's a strategic move. Hmm. Okay. Sever asked me to talk about the rest of my book, and then we took this. But so education, we talk about the ways in which these things try to replace human connection. We talk about this idea of doomsday. It's going to take over the world. It's going to be HAL 9000. It's going to kill people. We say how that's bullshit and how it's based in a fantasy. And we talk about the environmental impact, which we didn't even get to talk to today, where these things are, there's just power plants that have been decommissioned for years. And they're putting them back up. Three Mile Island, they brought Three Mile Island back online to power Microsoft AI data centers.
So let alone, I'm hearing like Bitcoin miners like Mara and Wolf and things like that. They're being repurposed after this last halving event. They have a lot of extra computing power, and they're being repurposed for a lot of these large language models and et cetera too. I guess I'm just taking it. Sam,
I hear you,
Alex,
Mike.
I'm taking it on the overall, just the words artificial intelligence and what that's meant to me, and just the words specifically, not the heady stuff. Mm-hmm. All you extra educated guys, all the I'm talking about the actual plug a thing into your brain, Skynet, whatchamacallit.
That's not Skynet either.
What I'm talking about. Semantics. Semantics, guys.
It's not semantics.
Use your context clues. You know what I'm saying.
This is what happens when we talk to the experts. I think I'm leaving personally. Yeah. This conversation.
It's very educational.
No, but this is what happened right now. I feel like nothing got resolved. And I feel like I have more questions than I had when I came into this podcast, which means that either we did a good job, me and you, Mike, or our guests did a good job. I can't call it, but I think I tell my students, I don't have answers. This is the perfect cop out. I don't have the answers, but I'm gonna teach you how to ask even more questions. That's the best. That's what I have.
Oh, yeah.
That's
in my head today. I'm about to get everybody's phone number and just call you at 2:30 in the morning. No, but see what I meant was, let me find out. What do you think about this?
Who is this? Who is this? What is this
number? Alex, we don't have time for that right now.
I will say it was nice. Thank you for having me. I loved it was nice to have Alex just confirm all the things that I do in practice with heady academic jargon and like research where I'm like, yeah, this feels bad. Let's not do it. And you're like, well, actually, and I'm like, ha ha, the data.
Right. Yeah. Dr. Hannah. So where can we get the new book? Can we plug the link? We could put it in the podcast notes for sure. It's called The AI Con. Is that correct?
The AI Con. This you can get it anywhere. It's not for pre-order yet, but just keep your eyes open for it.
Cool.
It's available wherever fine books are sold.
Excellent. And David, besides your students who catch you every day in the classroom, where can we catch you? I step out the comedy as much as I can. I'm always hitting up Mike like, what's going on tonight? Where can I see you?
Yeah,
I'll
man.
Come out. I want to support.
You can follow me on Instagram at David Donick.
Instagram. Yeah. What's that? Instasnap. Okay, got
God,
it.
You
okay.
Fucking boomers, dude.
Instasnap.
Yeah, dude. I you can follow me
Insta
on there.
Insta AOL. Sorry.
Yeah, Insta AOL. ChatGPT. Slay. I follow me on Instagram. I post all my shows there. Next week I'll be at the comedy bar. I'll be in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin for a show. So I don't know when this is gonna drop. It might be after October, but yeah, follow me on Instagram. I post all my shows monthly.
Say it one more time. Say your Instagram name one more time.
Yeah, it's at David Donick, DavidDonnick.
Yeah. Gotcha, man.
Very say it cool. twice. I'm still gonna edit it out. I'm a Gen Z, the best sounding one out of all of them.
That's true. That's true. I think I'm in your generation.
Yeah, definitely. No, that was dope. Thank you personally, Alex, for all your knowledge and insight on everything. It was so dope getting a chance to talk to you again, and this time officially. Dave, you're my guy. Thank you so much for your insight as well from the front lines when it comes to education, man. That was really dope to hear y'all's point of view and perspective. I'm keeping an eye out for the book. One more time, Alex, what was the name of the book?
The AI Con. How to fight big tech's hype and create the future we want. Also check out the podcast, Mystery AI Hype Theater 3000, wherever fine podcasts are sold. We talk about education, a few episodes, one episode with Haley Lepp. And then we also talk
I just talked to Haley today.
Yeah, Haley's great. we do another, I think we have another episode with another educator that's escaping me now, but check out we just finished recording episode 42 this morning. So yeah, we're about
you guys at episode 42. Excellent.
Yeah, and we're about to cross 100,000 downloads hopefully today or tomorrow. So
well, that's great. Everyone check out those links, and you guys are on episode 42. We're on episode 4. So
please don't forget to hit the smash the like.
Yeah, share it. So serious.
Subscribe, man.
We need a word out. This Mash. Is a cool concept. Every episode, I'm like, yeah, this is exactly the best part of my day. Being able to speak to comedians, to professors, scholars, researchers, activists. Today we had a special treat with Dr. Hannah and Mr. Don. Do they call you Mr. Don in the classroom?
They call me Mr. Donick. They try to call me Big D, and I'm like, let's not.
That's not that. We're not doing that.
Let's not.
No,
we can't.
Okay. Thank you both.
This has been a dope episode, man. I think we might have to run it back because, like you said, man, I got a lot more questions than when I started off with. So, and at the very least, we got to run it back when the book drops so that you can do an official promo. And then circle back with Dave, David, to find out how the school year is looking. So it's been so dope, man.
Same. Right. Y'all have a great night. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you guys for having me.
All right. Yeah, professional absolutely. Comedian, walker to a bar. I've been your co-host, Mike Knight, along with my other co-host.
Saper Vakil. Peace.
Dope. Peace.